Welcome to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Zaltzberg from the Herald Times. I'll be your host today, and we're going to be talking about this. We're going to be joining this national conversation over assisted suicide. The energy in the conversation picked up last month, or this month, actually, after California Governor Jerry Brown legalized the practice, making California the fourth state to do so. The new law is modeled after Oregon's Death with Dignity Act, which passed in 1997. It means physicians can prescribe pills to terminally ill patients to end their lives early. Indiana does not allow for assisted suicide. Today, we're going to talk about this topic with three experts who are joining us. David Orentlicker is a professor at the Indiana University McKinney School of Law. Rob Stone is with IU Health Hospice and Palliative Care Medicine. And George Amy is vice president of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon. If you want to join the program today, you can give us a call at 812-855-0811 in Bloomington or 1-877-285-9348 outside of the Bloomington calling area. You can also join the live chat. That's at WFIU.org/noonedition. And you can follow us on Twitter at Noon Edition. So welcome to all of you to the program. We have two joining us by phone. So Rob's in the studio. Rob?
I'm here. I'm glad to be here.
Good to have you back. David Orentlicker has been with us before on this program, and he's joining us, even though he's a professor in Indianapolis at the IU McKinney School of Law. He's joining us from Texas, where he's at a professional meeting. And, of course, George Amy is in Oregon. So we have three different time zones represented today. So we're happy to have all three with us. I wanted to go to George first. George, I know that I went to your website today, and I believe there was a quote from you, or maybe it was on your blog, where you said that words couldn't describe the atmosphere at Death with Dignity after California passed its law. Could you talk about the, you know, that law and why it was so important to you?
Well, first of all, thank you for the opportunity to help educate Indianians on this Death with Dignity law. When California's governor signed the piece of legislation, first of all, let me just say, we were very, very pleased that he signed it and his signing statement as well, because we anticipated that he might receive a great deal of pressure not to sign and just let the law go into effect without signature. But he boldly went forward and said, this is something that people should have the option to do. And the impact is somewhat immeasurable. When you figure that California, with 39 million people, are now going to have this opportunity, the data that will be coming out of California will have an impact across the country, showing that the law does work and that it works well, and that all the safeguards and protections that were placed in California's law, even a little bit more than that were in Oregon's law, will disprove the fears of a lot of people who object to it. Now, remember, the law clearly allows for an opt-out. No one is required to use it. Doctors can opt out. Pharmacies can opt out. Hospices can opt out. Hospitals, anyone can opt out of the law if they are against it for religious reasons, moral reasons, ethical reasons. No one is ever forced to use it. So we were very, very pleased that Oregon's model is now the model in California, Washington, and Vermont, making for a total of 50 million U.S. citizens that can avail themselves of this type of option.
Now, you were in the state legislature in Oregon. Were you there at the time when this bill passed in Oregon?
I was. Mm-hmm. I was there in both years, in 1994. When it passed the first time by a margin of 51-49%, and the second time when it passed by a margin of 60-40%.
And so what it sounds as if the experience in Oregon has been positive, that a lot of the fears and a lot of the anxiety about this law have not really come true.
Correct. One of the things that we did well in Oregon was to mandate that there be annual reporting and documentation, because we wanted to actually disprove some of those fears and our own concerns. What happened was we found out that the opposition said that 25%, first of all, 25% of all the people who took the medicine would wake up. Well, that has not been the case. It's been less than 1%, if that. It's 6 people out of almost 1,000 people. And that they would be pressured into using the law. Well, it's found out that it's exact opposite. It's the loved ones who want their dying loved person to take another chemo, another radiation, go to Mexico for another experiment. So that has been disproved. Minorities have not been the subject of this. Over 95% of the people who use the law are Caucasian. And almost 50% have a bachelor's of art degree. And as far as receiving proper health care, we have also shown that 93% are enrolled in hospice at the time they take the medicine. And the other fear that was said that Oregon would become the dying state, people would move here by the thousands to use our law. Well, in 17 years, only a little over 1,300 people have actually received the medicine, and about 860 have used it. Well, that's one-third of the people who get the medication never use it, and that total percentage of who do use it is less than 0.02% of all the people who die in the state of Oregon. We have 33,000 people who die in the state of Oregon every year. And when you figure that in 17 years, only 860 people died taking the medicine. But the one factor that is significant is that the comfort and ease of mind that knowing this option is available gives huge, huge relief to thousands of people who are dying. And that, in and of itself, justifies having such a law on the books.
All right. Thank you. That's George Amy, who's vice president of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon. We'll have George will be right back with you, but I want to bring David Orenlicher onto the program. David, as I said before, is a professor at the IU McKinney School of Law, so he's a lawyer, but he also is an adjunct professor of medicine at Indiana University School of Medicine. And before coming to IU, he served as director of the Division of Medical Ethics at the American Medical Association. So, David, your perspective from, you know, the medical ethics standpoint, and do you think that now that California has done this, do you think that we're going to see this this issue coming up in a lot of other states, including our own in Indiana?
Yeah, the good questions, and thank you for having me. On the first, you know, a lot of this, the whole question of end-of-life care and when it's time to stop and not prolong the suffering of somebody who's dying, you know, we can trace it back to the 1970s when the question was, can we turn off ventilators and stop dialysis? Because patients die when you do that. And we, starting with the Quinlan case in New Jersey, and then it spread throughout every state, that we do recognize that. And what's driving it is this sense that when people have a serious and irreversible disease and we can't do anything to cure it, that it comes to the point where we turn from prolonging life to prolonging the dying process. And our society views it when we get to the point where people are suffering and all we're doing is prolonging their death in a painful way, that it's okay to say, let's stop this and, you know, provide palliative care and relieve my suffering, but don't try to extend a life that you know, it has lost its quality. And whether you do that with withdrawal of treatment or aid in dying when you take pills, it's the same sentiment. But people have worried, and that's what's slowed the adoption of aid in dying, is, but couldn't there be abuses? And people worried about what's happened in the Netherlands. But as George says, we haven't seen that. It's been done very carefully in Oregon and the other states, and we've got more than 15 years of experience that it's used rarely and safely. And I think there are two important safeguards that explain why it's gone well here, and we haven't seen the concerns that people have worried about in the Netherlands and Belgium. And that is It's aid in dying. It's the patient gets a prescription to take the pills. It has to be an adult who's competent, who's not, you know, lost their ability to make medical decisions. We don't have euthanasia where a physician could inject a death-causing drug into somebody who's, you know, has Alzheimer's disease. We don't have that here. It's just aid in dying that a competent adult has to do. And the patient has to be terminally ill. It has to be diagnosed as a cancer. And that's what most, I think it's 80% of the patients in Oregon have cancer. It's not somebody who, what we see in, the concerns in Netherlands and other places is with patients who aren't terminally ill and they have sometimes ill-defined medical problems, and the question is it psychiatric dysfunction that's driving them rather than a serious irreversible disease? And Oregon is protected against that in Vermont and Washington and the other states by saying you have to have a terminal disease, a cancer, or other serious and irreversible illness where death is expected within 6 months.
So what about the second part of the question then? Do you think it's going to be that now is a time when it's going to really be on the public radar again and start getting a lot of discussion in various state legislatures?
Yeah, I think so. And mm-hmm. when you go back to when the Supreme Court decided there wasn't a right to aid in dying in 1997, one of the things that was clear was, you know, we don't have enough experience with it to reassure us about it. Oregon had just legalized it. And I think if you go back now and you say that in the public sees, we've got more than 15 years of experience, it's gone well. It's gone well in some smaller states, now California. And I think when people continue to see that this is an option that for people who are dying that can relieve their suffering and it can be done safely and with, you know, and California is a very big state, and I think that will provide sufficient reassurance that other states will follow the example, and maybe even the Supreme Court will say, now we're comfortable enough to say we can recognize it as a fundamental right.
All right, I'm going to bring Rob Stone on here in just a second, but I want to give our phone numbers again first, 812-855-0811 in Bloomington, 1-877-285-9348 outside of the Bloomington area. You can also join the live chat at WFIU.org/noonedition, and you can follow us on Twitter at Noon Edition. We're talking about death with dignity or aid in dying, right to die, assisted suicide, various names for this. Rob, I should tell our listeners, Rob Stone's been with us many times before talking about the Affordable Care Act and a variety of things. And he spent 28 years in emergency room settings, and now he is working in hospice care and palliative care. Define palliative care for me, would you? Just.
I'm glad you're giving me a chance to address that because it's not necessarily the most intuitive name to explain what we do. But palliative care grew out of hospice care, and all hospice care is palliative in nature. We're focusing on reducing suffering and treating symptoms. But hospice in the United States is limited to people who have this 6 month diagnosis, 6 month prognosis of life expectancy, which is the same number that's used in the death with dignity legislation. But we found that there are people who still are seeking treatment, who are still trying to move forward with curative chemotherapy and surgery and so on, who can benefit from some of the same approaches. And so palliative care is available for people who are at any stage in the process of a life-shortening or threatening disease, not just at the very end, which is hospice, and I do hospice work as well.
Mm-hmm. So in your work in hospice, I mean, I don't want to make any assumptions at all, but is this the kind of law that you would like for Indiana to pass?
Okay, so that's a very interesting question. I have followed this debate very closely, and I have given some public presentations around Bloomington on the subject, and so I've phrased it slightly differently to myself. I've tended to think, and I'd be interested to hear David's opinion on this, that that Indiana may well be a long way away from adapting a law like this. But I've also wondered, you know, how would I feel about being the person prescribing the medication to help someone die? And this is something that I'm asked not rarely. You know, in the work I do, it's you know, a fairly frequent thing that someone will ask me. And at this point, I say, well, Indiana doesn't have a law, and I can't do that. And then what can we do from here to try to help relieve your suffering and deal with the issues that you're facing? And so I think if Indiana did pass such a law, I think I would probably be a I think almost certainly I would be a prescriber, but I don't really know how it would feel until I get there. There's a certain part of me that kind of gulps a little bit and thinks, wow, that is a step beyond what I've done so far in my work. And so I'll be interested to see and interested in, particularly in David's opinion, if he thinks there's anything likely to rise on the legislative horizon here in Indiana anytime soon.
David?
Yeah, I think with California, we'll see other states follow in the next few years. I wouldn't put Indiana at the top of my list as the next state. That I think there, where we tend to be more conservative on these adopting these kinds of changes than some of the other states. So I would expect to see New York, Illinois, Wisconsin, Michigan, Minnesota, states like that before Indiana. But I think people will be more receptive to discussing it. And one of the things I learned as a legislator is you have to build for something like this, lay the groundwork, and so it's certainly reasonable to start the discussion now among legislators, and then over time, I think there will be more receptivity to it as they see that the experience works well.
George, I'd like to get your reaction to what Rob said, Dr. Stone said. What's been the physician reaction in Oregon?
Well, he is typical of what the physicians were going through in the beginning. When I first became the executive director of the organization that facilitated the implementation of Oregon's law, we had about 20, 25 doctors at the most who were willing to participate because it was so new and so strange that it took several years of education and also proving to them that palliative care and hospice care could go hand in hand with a person going through the dying process and wanting this law. And that's why we show that one-third of the people who get the medication never take it. They die peacefully in hospice or receiving palliative care. So when I would reach out, I went to the Oregon only has one medical school, Oregon Health Sciences University. We would go there. We talked to students. We would talk to professors. We went into the medical associations, the Oregon Medical Association, and talked to groups of doctors. And finally, when I left and joined the national movement, National Center, we had over 1,200 of the probably 6,000 doctors who would be eligible to do death with dignity. We had over 1,200 who had participated or who were willing to participate either as the prescribing physician or the second opinion. And generally, it was the second opinion doctors who became prescribing physician after they went through the process a couple times and they found out that morally and ethically they were doing good for their patients instead of doing harm. And it was very rewarding to hear that. And I can tell you, I'm working with a doctor right now who is dying of glioblastoma. And he was initially opposed to the law back in 1998, and he became a prescribing physician. And now he is facing his own death and is going through the process. So it's transformational. It is really a difficult thing to do, and I understood that. And so we were willing to reach out and educate physicians, nurses, hospices. When we first started, hospices were totally opposed to this, absolutely opposed. It took me about 3-4 years of going to hospice after hospice to educate them on that this was not an either-or situation. People could take hospice. And then when they found out that because the person felt more comfortable talking to their hospice personnel about their pain and suffering, because they knew they had this option, hospices throughout the state then became participants. In fact, many hospice personnel now are present when the person takes the lethal dose of medication, which, by the way, just as an aside, is not a pill. It's not a bunch of pills. It is prescribed in the form sometimes of pills that are separated and dissolved into 4 to 5 ounces of water or applesauce. And now we have a new protocol that is totally liquid. And so it's not, and it has to be self-administered by, of course. No one can inject you. No one can pour it down your throat. No one can pour it down your feeding tube. You must be able to do it yourself.
All right. We're about at halftime, and I think I have a lot more questions, but they're going to take long answers, I'm sure, because it's a very difficult issue that we're talking about today. We're talking about California's new Death with Dignity Act that's based on Oregon's Death with Dignity Act. We have three guests with us. Rob Stone is here in the studio with me, and David Orentlicker, professor at the IU McKinney School of Law and an adjunct professor at the medical school in Indianapolis, is joining us by phone from Texas, where he is at a professional meeting. And George Amy, vice president of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon, is also here. We hope you'll join us after we take this short break. We'll be right back.
This is New in Addition on WFIU. Production support comes from Smithville Fiber, online at smithville.com, and IU School of Public Health Bloomington, online at publichealth.indiana.edu. WFIU News covers South Central Indiana and the state each day. You can read news throughout the day as it's posted on our website at wfiunews.org. And you can pick up a digest of all the top stories. It's like a newspaper delivered to your inbox each weekday afternoon. It's a free and easy way to stay on top of not only the headlines, but also the in-depth audio, video, and print news stories you can't get anywhere else. Subscribe right now at wfiunews.org.
Welcome back to Noon Edition. I'm Bob Salzberg from the Herald Times. We're going to jump right back into our conversation about death with dignity. And, you know, we have three guests that I introduced right before we went to break. If you want to join the program, though, if you have a call or a question, please, 812-855-0811 in Bloomington, 1-877-285-9348 outside of the Bloomington area. You can also join live chat at wfiu.org/noonedition, and you can follow us on Twitter at noonedition. Dr. Rob Stone, I wanted to ask you about what George Amy just said when he was talking about talking with hospice physicians and talking with doctors and being able to convince them. I guess, I don't know if convince is the right word, but have them see that. They were doing good for their patients instead of doing harm, because you, as a physician, the Hippocratic Oath is what you stand by. First is the first line. It says, first, do no harm. I mean, how do you judge whether assisting someone in dying is the right thing or perhaps doing harm?
Well, right now I have, you know, a lot of experience with helping patients and families decide things like withdrawing ventilators, and we have patients. You know, we have a hospice house in Bloomington with 12 rooms where people sometimes may go when they're near the end, and sometimes there's a lot of suffering, and so we give sometimes very, very large doses of medication to people, and even to the point of basically making people unconscious who seem to be suffering a lot, particularly with cancer pain as they're dying. And And that has become something I'm very comfortable doing, and I think, you know, reasonably skillful at doing. I was pleased when George said that my position is typical, because there is still a little part of me that says, okay, so now it's going to be a little different to write a prescription for someone who is walking and talking, and maybe not walking, but talking, and it's going to be a little different. But like I said, I think I'm not going to know until I've done it. But I suspect I'm actually fairly confident that I would go ahead and write that prescription, because I do have that experience right now of people who are very articulate in telling me why they understand that they're dying. They may be having a fair amount of suffering right now. They see more suffering coming ahead, and they want to make this choice, which in some ways seems like a big difference from what I already do, but in other ways seems like an insignificant difference from what I already do.
Mm-hmm. All right, we've had a...
The doctor's role here.
Now, we have everybody wants to get on this one. Let's go with David first, and then George. Okay. David?
Yeah, so I'll give you a couple of examples. I've never had experience myself, but other doctors, one, a close friend who was treated patients with kidney disease and had a patient who was on dialysis for many years and came to the point that she wanted to stop her dialysis. The quality of life just wasn't deteriorated. And, you know, after a number of discussions, he felt that this was her, you know, thoughtful and considered decision, and it was her right to refuse unwanted treatment. And so they made the arrangements, and they stopped the dialysis. But it would take a couple weeks for her to die. And, you know, at some point into those 2 weeks, the suffering, she started suffering from, you know, her kidney failure that wasn't being treated with the dialysis. And that, you know, question came up. It wasn't legal, so he couldn't do it, but he felt that if he was going to really meet her needs in terms of suffering, that's what he would have had to do, and that by not doing that, in a way, it was causing harm to her. Or the other situation you have is somebody who's maybe had a serious cancer, gone through a lot of chemotherapy, and that has side effects too. And now you're suffering from the side effects, and maybe, you know, the usual medications aren't sufficient. Well, if you can't then, you know, as a last resort, provide a prescription for pills, in some sense, you're abandoning the patient at a time of need if you can't provide them the care that they need to relieve their suffering.
George?
Well, what I was going to say to Dr. Stone is what he is, the thought process he's going through. I saw the change in several doctors when total sedation or terminal sedation, whatever you want to call it, where you address the pain and suffering of the individual with large doses of pain management, with the intent to address the pain, knowing full well that the likelihood death will occur, is what is practiced predominantly in the United States already when it comes to addressing pain. And what doctors in Oregon started saying was, well, wait a minute, if my intent is just to address pain, and yet I know intellectually and medically that death will occur, then all I'm doing in prescribing this pain, this medication under Oregon's Death with Dignity law, is to recognize that my intent is still just to address the pain and suffering. So I think that's where that struggle occurs in many doctors, and it's not easy. But I saw the transformation in many physicians when they recognized, yes, I know what I'm doing. I feel comfortable in addressing this person's suffering. Now, remember, pain is not necessarily the primary reason for people using the law. The primary reason for people using the law is the loss of autonomy or the fear of loss of autonomy, and that's the sort of the loss of a quality of life that has become acceptable to them. And pain is way down because, as Dr. Stone said, we can address pain. We can address pain to the point where we put the person in a comatose state, but that's still not the quality of life that person wants.
We've had a question come in from Twitter, and it says, disability, well, it's actually a comment. Disability rights advocates lead the opposition to assisted suicide and sort of chastising us for having no representation from that group of people here. I would say two things about that, I guess. One is, if anyone out there is a disability rights advocate, that we would be happy to hear from them to give us a call. And two, I just want the reactions from all three of our panelists, but particularly George and David, as from your perspectives about this comment that disability rights advocates lead the opposition to this.
There is a small group of disabled individuals called a Not Yet Dead Yet group, and they are very vocal about their opposition. However, the largest disabilities group organization in the United States, the National Disabilities Group, supports this law, and its executive director is supportive of the law, and so are the rank and file. We've specifically addressed that issue. In 1999, because the Not Dead Yet group came to us and said that you are denigrating the existence of you're denigrating our very existence by saying that people can use this law, and most of them are in some ways disabled. Of course, you're disabled when you're having a terminal diagnosis that no longer allows you to do those things that you would normally do, but it's a totally different disability. At the end of which you're going to die, and it's different than having some type of disability that may require you to have a wheelchair or some other types of disabilities. So we put in the law in 1999 to address that. I specifically amended the law to say no person may use the law solely based upon a disability or age, so that yet that did not satisfy this small vocal group, and that was unfortunate. And I am one of the strongest advocates for disability rights. I sponsored bill after bill, protecting it, ensuring it, and access, and so I would be the last person to ever denigrate that group of people. So the protections are there, and it's just unfortunate that they are unwilling to see that.
Just so to clarify for me, George, it sounds like the law in Oregon and perhaps in California, which is so similar, that first of all, a physician would have to prescribe the medication. It sounds like the diagnosis would have to be that this is terminal within 6 months. Is that what you said earlier?
Yeah, the process is very easy. Mm-hmm. First of all, it must be the person who raises the issue and makes the request. Then they have to have two physicians say that they are mentally competent and that they have a diagnosis that's terminal and a prognosis of less than 6 months. They must go through two oral requests and a written request, and they must be able to self-administer. So there are a lot of safeguards, and the time, the average length of time from first request to taking the medicine is around 45 days. So it's not, you can't just call up a doctor and say, give me the prescription. It's just impossible. We make sure that the person is mentally alert, knowing. And in California, one of the other safeguards that we put into the bill was that 48 hours prior to the person's intended taking of the medication, they must fill out a form saying that they are intending to take it, they know the consequences, no one has coerced them to do so, and that must be turned into the physician as well. So there's all kinds of protections.
All right. David, do you want to add anything to that?
No, I just like to reinforce, George is exactly right. The safeguards in these states, California and Oregon and Washington and Vermont, the terminal illness requirement is so critical because it really does distinguish the person who's got a disability that they could live for many years, whether in a wheelchair or with other aids, from somebody who's really in the dying process. And the reality is, so we haven't seen that the kind of problem that the disability rights advocates have raised in California, in Oregon, and other states. But when you don't have that eligibility threshold of terminal illness, then yes, it does. The problems do arise, and we see it with the refusal of life-sustaining treatment. There are a number of cases of people who have broken their necks and become quadriplegic and ventilator dependent, and have, you know, raised the question of turning off their ventilator. And there have been serious questions about part of the reason why they've asked for that is because they're not getting sufficient support, social supports, and that, you know, they feel like they're, it's not worth living, and then when assistance comes forward, they change their mind. So yes, we do have to worry about that, but because we limit aid in dying to terminal illness, the problem hasn't come up in that setting.
Let me ask a question about advanced directives. I mean, when you talk about the situation you described, where a ventilator is keeping someone alive, would an advanced directive take care of that for that person? That is, if they don't want to be kept alive by artificial means?
In Oregon, first of all, we have two things. We have advanced directives, which are about nationally recognized. About 70% of the time, they're recognized by EMTs and physicians, about 30% not recognized. So they're not totally reliable, but we do, of course, encourage people. But they have no legal effect when it comes to whether or not to use organs, death, or dignity law. You cannot have a surrogate. But when it comes to withholding hydration and nutrition, or when it comes to withholding life support systems, yes, you can direct, you can have a durable power of attorney to do that. The other one that is the most significant, and Oregon was the first state to introduce what's called a PULTS form. And in Oregon, that stands for Physician's Order for Life-Sustaining Treatment. And in Oregon, it's a bright pink form. In Washington now, it's a bright green. In California, another pink or something. But now it's swept the country. And you're going to find that PULTS forms are almost every state now. I think Indiana has one, but
yeah.
And so these forms are signed by the physician, and in those forms, when you are facing an end of life issue, they have about 95% that are respected in those forms, because when you have it over your bed or over your bathroom door or whatever, and the EMT comes in, they're honoring that. No life support, no DNR, that type of thing.
I was trying to draw the distinction between the 6-month diagnosis for the Death with Dignity Act and the fact that there are other possibilities for patients here. Dr. Stone?
Well, I just wanted to put in a plug for Indiana's law, which instead of pulsed is post physician's orders for scope of treatment, but it's based on the same laws, and it's been in place now for about 2.5 years in Indiana, and it's a advanced directive form that I use quite a bit in my work. In fact, I think I signed 2 or 3 posts this week. The post form in Indiana and in nationally is not necessarily for every single person who is thinking about what they may want at end of life. It's really for people who are facing a life-threatening or life-shortening illness. And so it's a very specific form, and it's not something that, you know, every listener here needs to run out and do, although I always advise people to do advanced directives, You know, when you're 18 years old, you can do an advance directive. But the post form is specific, is very specific for people who are facing a life-threatening or life-shortening illness.
All right. We have a phone call from Brown County, and it's Sandy from Brown County. Go ahead.
Hi.
Hi.
I am against the death penalty, and I would like to know, though, why the drug you're using for self-directed death cannot be used in those cases and not be as traumatic as they seem to be.
Okay, good question. So the question is, you know, the death penalty, of course, is very controversial. This drug, could it be used by states as in a death penalty case?
Well, first of all, it is one of the drugs that is used in the death penalty cases. And that's why we no longer can get it. And that's why we had to come up with a new combination of prescribed medication that would never be used in a death penalty case because they have to be in series of combination and cannot be used intravenously. The drug was phenobarbital. Phenobarbital no longer comes to the United States because we have a death penalty. The manufacturer in Europe has refused based upon the fact that the botched death penalty case, I think it was in New Mexico, I can't remember, or Oklahoma, one of them, they refused to send it. So now we've been, and secobarbital, which is the other barbiturate that was used, is the one that comes in pill form, and we separate the pills and take the powder out, is now become cost prohibitive, ranging. We used to be able to get 10 grams for about $200. Now it's over $3,000 to $5,000. And so we've been forced to go to this new formula, which is working quite well. It cost around $450.
All right. Sandy, I guess that's our best answer for you.
All right. Thank you. I appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much for the call. We have about 10 more minutes to go. If you want to give us a call, 812-855-0811 in Bloomington or 1-877-285-9348 outside of the Bloomington calling area. You can also join the live chat at wfiu.org/noonedition, and you can follow us on Twitter at Noon Edition. I know this is very controversial topic, but I listened to the three of you talk about it very rationally, and it seems as if having the option available sounds plausible. You know, the one tweet we had about disability rights advocates, I think you addressed that very, very well. So what is the opposition? George, can you start that conversation?
Well,
what is the opposition to this?
The main opposition is religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. And we believe we have addressed that by providing the absolute right to opt out. And in many, many cases, I have told people, I respect your religious beliefs, please just respect that I have the right to do this. That's all I ask in return. I have been honored to be at the bedside of more than four dozen people who have taken this medicine. And I have been confronted by those who are religiously opposed, and all I ask is what I just said, because I can tell you the courage of the individuals who do this, who take that last drink, is the most incredible courage in the world. I want the option, but I don't know if I could do it. You just don't know until you face that time. So the religious opposition is number one. The Catholic Church in particular spends millions and millions of dollars. Wherever we go in California, they spend millions of dollars trying to oppose the law. In Massachusetts, we lost by 51% to 49% in the 2012 election, and the Catholic Church poured in millions of dollars. So it's in Oregon they did, yeah, we were outspent 3-1 in Oregon, but we won that first time by 51% to 49%. And then, of course, the second tier of opposition are politicians who are very conservative in their beliefs about this because they believe the sanctity of life. So religion is mixed with their political beliefs, and but they sometimes have a larger platform from which to express their opinions. Those are the two primary ones that we have run into over the years.
Okay. We have a phone call I think might be somewhat related to this question, too. But Jack from Bloomington, go ahead.
Yeah, I've heard a couple of the people talk about how the doctors at first resist the idea of giving a pill that will hasten death. But then once they get used to it, it's okay. I'm concerned about if the public in general goes through the same process, won't we feel as individuals pressure to make use of it? And I know that one of the speakers said that loved ones don't, in fact, pressure, but I'm talking about internal pressure. As somebody like myself, I'm in my 80s. I don't think it's right to hasten death in that fashion. But I would look at the cost. It's costing everybody. The pain is costing everybody. And I think I'd feel very considerable pressure to make use of this this means. And I think that's a source of concern.
Mm-hmm. All right. Dr. Stone, you want to take a shot at that?
I think that's a very valid and thoughtful concern. I think that one of the, I think, really admirable things about the way they've done things in Oregon is, and George has alluded to this, the transparency and the significant efforts to try to make this an open process. And so I'm going to say one more thing, and then maybe ask George to speak to this too, yeah, I think that so far we haven't really seen that happening. But what the listener Jack mentioned is a real concern. Now, I also want to put this in a little bit different perspective for Jack. There is, you know, a friend of mine in Seattle is a palliative care physician named Tony Back, and many years ago he published a piece in the Journal of the American Medical Association that in the state of Washington they did a poll of physicians, and this is many years ago. I think it was 12% of physicians reported having had requests for physician assisted in dying, and so I think that so this is not a rare thing to come up. And so many physicians right now feel, on humanitarian terms, they want to help their patients. But in states like Indiana, it is totally locked in secrecy and privacy. It's a totally non-transparent process where physicians are afraid of being charged with abetting in a murder. Patients are afraid that they're going to get their loved ones in trouble. Their wives and children who want to help them in this difficult time, but they don't want their loved ones to be charged with assisting in a murder. And so the non-transparent current situation, to me, is actually one of the strongest arguments for the transparent process that the Death with Dignity laws seem to provide.
It sounds as if Jack's concern is about the pressure that people will feel, and it sounds like you're saying people already feel pressure, but just in a different direction.
Right.
I think Jack is exactly right. You know, the idea that when you give people a right to die, it can become a duty to die. We clearly have to worry about that. But I would say, you know, in some sense, we've had that a greater concern with withdrawal of treatment, that when somebody's on a ventilator or dialysis, the cost of their care can, you know, hundreds of thousands and sometimes in the millions of dollars. And we understand that can happen, and we, you know, do the best we can to protect against it. And we've been comfortable with giving these rights, even knowing we have to worry about the risk. But and with the death and dying, aid in dying, we're not seeing it. It certainly is something we have to worry about, but we're not seeing evidence of that. because of the strict safeguards. So yes, we, you know, any time you make a change like this, you have to weigh benefits and risks, and what we've seen is that the benefits outweigh the risks.
George, 30 seconds.
Yeah, very quickly. We took Jack's concern very seriously, and the process requires private consultation with physicians to make sure that there is no coercion or undue pressure internally or externally. That insurance, 95% of these people have health insurance that covers the expenses, so there's not a depletion of one's asset. The hospice, 95% in hospice, making sure that their quality of life is such that it is closest to acceptable as possible, so they don't feel any pressure to do this whatsoever. And the fact, the data shows, one-third get the medicine, never take it. Therefore, the pressure is not there. And the numbers, they're very, very low. And so this indicates to us that even internal pressure is not making people use this law at all.
All right. Thank you. We are out of time. That was George Amey, the vice president of the Death with Dignity National Center in Portland, Oregon, joining us today by phone. Thank you also to Rob Stone, Dr. Rob Stone, and David Orenlicher. Appreciate both of them being here. For producer Drew Dodlin and engineer Mike Pashkash, I'm Bob Zaltzberg. Thanks for listening.
Noon Edition is a production of WFIU and the Herald Times. A podcast of this and other WFIU programs is available at WFIU.org.
Production support comes from School of Public Health, Bloomington. Public Health Reimagined, addressing 21st century health challenges with a multidisciplinary approach to disease prevention, health promotion, and enhancing quality of life. publichealth.indiana.edu.
And Smithville Fiber, the GigaCity Company. Fiber Internet, HD, and digital IPTV in Southern Indiana. More information at smithville.com.